Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa!
Potluck. And hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here at the end of May, the end of Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, APAM. We're here to talk about our May 2019 book club pick, This is Paradise by Christiana Kahakawila, a collection of short stories featuring the voices of Native Hawaiians.
Yes. As always, this is your spoiler warner.
Spoiler warner, because that rhymes.
It's been a very, very long day. I sound really tired in this episode because I barely had enough sleep. But yeah. but I was really excited to read a book by a Pacific Islander mm-hmm. author this time around because we usually focus on Asian American writers, like we say in our intro every single episode, but you know, like, change of pace.
I feel like we say that just to cover our bases a little bit, just because it is a little bit harder to find works by Pacific Islanders in the mainstream canon sometimes.
Yeah, I know that for Christiana's book, it may have been a little bit difficult for some people to get a hold of. There's not a lot of copies of it, like paperback wise, in terms of like your mainstream bookstores. The easiest way to get a hold of it is through Kindle.
I read mine on Kindle, yeah.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have a library that had it. two libraries around me had a copy, so you know, that was really nice.
We still haven't done that thing where we follow me to get my library card for the first time in
two decades. Is for. I guess for crowdfunding, we have to have like an incentive for people to give us money.
Yeah. I was really excited to read this book too, just because we haven't read a PI author since, I think...
The Whale Rider.
Which was one of... We read that in the first year, right?
Yeah, we read that in our very, very first year.
And our intent for this podcast was always to be inclusive of all API identities.
Yeah. I also really wanted to read something somewhat modern, because a lot of PI books that are sent to me are usually books from, like, the late 90s. And I'm like, yo, it is 2019. Like, we need to read something from the last 10 years at the very least.
And there were a lot of parallels, I thought, with our last book, Bangkok Wakes the Rain, with the tensions between modernization and traditions.
Yes, right? Yes. That was totally on purpose. Yes.
But before we get to our book discussion, Rira, you said you had some news you wanted to share.
Yeah, some quick bullet points. So first up, congratulations to Celeste Ng. Her book, Little Fires Everywhere, reached number one on the New York Times bestsellers list for paperback fiction. And Celeste Ng, we read her debut novel for this book club. It was like our third pick, I think. I'm not sure which month we read it in, but it was like one of our very, very early choices. And it was a very popular choice, too. A lot of our members said that they really enjoyed Everything I Never Told You. Mm-hmm. And I've read Little Fires Everywhere, and I absolutely freaking love this book. And I'm so stoked for the Hulu series that's going to come up.
Yeah. So this is my not familiar with how charts work, but there's a separate chart for paperback and hardcover?
Yes. I mean, America's weird in terms of like data for books.
what about those books that start out in softcover? They just never have a chance in the hardcover?
No, it would be in paperback fiction.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it wouldn't be categorized as hardcover.
So most books have a chance to get on that list twice then?
Yeah, they do. I mean, it depends on like how well they do in sales for the first couple weeks.
That seems a little broken maybe, but...
See, I love hardcover books, but I also have a love-hate relationship with it because when I went to Asia...
it cost like a gajillion dollars.
Well, yeah, one. And like when I went to Asia, everything was soft covers. Like they don't really have hardcover books.
And they're like shrink-wrapped.
Yeah, they're shrink-wrapped and you can like bend the paperback without damaging it. And it's like really portable and nice. Whereas with hardcover books, they're so big and heavy and there's no way to like carry it around in your purse or anything. So I'm like, yeah, hardcovers look really nice on my bookshelves, but I also don't read them when like I'm on the go.
That's true. I carry my backpack everywhere, so I just like throw it in there.
Yeah.
Instead of like another thing.
Well, you have a Kindle now, so that probably affected.
Game changer.
Yeah, really, really is. 3 years into this podcast, Marvin, you finally get an ebook reader.
I mean, I've had a Kindle account because I used to read it on my iPad. I had an iPad too, I had a Kindle on though. So I had a whole library on it. I just haven't had an actual Kindle until recently.
I mean, they're all the same. I read most of my books on my phone now because I have the Kindle app on here. But moving on to our last piece of news, Harper Children's bought 3 graphic novels. 2 of them are middle grade and 1 of them is YA by Wendy Hsu, who is the co-creator of Mooncakes. One of the books is called Tide Song and it's set to release in 2021. And the story features an ambitious 12-year-old who moves to a seaside town with her aunts. And she's an apprentice in magic, and she realizes that it may be more than she bargained for. And the second book is due out a year after Tide Song. The YA graphic novel is called The Infinity Particle, and it's described to be kind of similar to Ghost in the Shell. And it's about a young woman whose best friend and first love suddenly reappears in her life after being presumed dead for about 3 years. And I think that's going to be published in 2023.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's but cool.
Congratulations to Wendy. Six
that's
figures.
Awesome.
That's pretty.
That's a lot of money to do what you
three,
love.
And 3 books, too. Congratulations, indeed.
That's more money than I make ever.
I mean, writing is hard. Writing is hard. And I say get as much as you can for it because I feel like writers don't get paid enough.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with those quick book news stories out of the way, let's get into our book. Rira, tell us about our May Book Club pick.
And I'm reading from the jacket description as always. In a stunning collection that announces the arrival of an incredible talent, Christiana Kahakuila travels the islands of Hawaii, making the fabled place her own. Exploring the deep tensions between local and tourist, tradition and expectation, facade and authentic self, This Is Paradise provides an unforgettable portrait of life as it's truly being lived on Maui, Oahu, Kauai, and the Big Island. And excuse any mispronunciation I have of Hawaiian names.
None of us are from Hawaii.
Yes. It is very, very difficult, at least for me, because I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah.
I'm sure if I had, like... for example, if I was listening to this on like audiobook, I would probably get the pronunciation down just from the sheer repetition of it being said in my ears. But since I read this in paperback, I will be butchering names. And I apologize deeply for that before we go into the talk.
Yeah. So right off the bat, I really, really enjoyed this series of short stories. I liked all of them.
Yeah, yes.
A lot, yeah.
This was our first short story collection, which is, it's very different from reading a novel. I'm not really quite sure how we should go about talking about the stories, but I think the first story is a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, the titular, This Is Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked how it used us and our as the framing for the narrative. And that's not second person, right? That's somewhat first person.
That's first person.
Yeah.
It's first person, but it's plural.
Mm.
And I actually really, like, I think it was last week. I think in last week's episode, I said that I really, really liked the first story in this collection. It definitely, like grabs you and reels you in.
Yeah.
Which is usually the case with short story collections. The first one is going to be the one that, like, really lures you in. And I really like the fact that it was told in three different vantage points. Mm-hmm. So you have three different groups of women. You have the first group of women who are surfers, who are locals, and the second group of women who are housekeepers in like a resort hotel. And then the third group of women are like corporate women who I think most of them went to the mainland for college and then they came back to be successful businesswomen.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting that it was the story of a tourist throughout, but told from the perspectives of the local women.
Yes.
Right?
There was definitely, I really like that juxtaposition between like, because the first story takes place in Waikiki.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like the glamorous tourist version of Waikiki, and then you have it, you're seeing it through like a local's perspective where it's not as glamorous. There is like some provincial parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And and I also really like the suspense aspect to the story. It was very Law and Order.
Kind of, yeah.
It was just like after like one group of women would see Susan, the foreigner, would be like, dun dun.
Is that what played in your head during those scenes?
Yeah.
I mean, it was really interesting how it, right off the bat, gives you the Hawaii that you see in movies and TV, but immediately also peels off that paint, right? By showing you this is a real place where real people work. And the perspectives are all from working women,
mm-hmm.
right? And they all have this relationship with being quote unquote local, right?
Yeah. I think all of Christiana's stories explore what it means to be a local, what does it mean to be Hawaiian but not local, and what it means to be native versus like being a foreigner, and how foreigners are seen through all of these different subgroups' perspectives. And it was really interesting because Susan kind of, she was a completely different person for each
yeah.
group of women. So you have like the surfers who are like, oh, it's like another white lady in a bikini and just here on vacation. And then you have like the housekeepers who are like, yeah, she seems to be a sensible woman and very much nicer than the other like white ladies who are staying at this hotel. And then you have the corporate women who are kind of like, why is she being so...
Well, I think they see her as someone they were.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like
yeah.
naive and less structured.
Yeah.
Right? Because all of the perspectives and all of the different viewpoints, they carry their own tensions too. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like...
When the first element of danger pops up, mm-hmm. When they're at the bar and it's the surfer girls with Susan, they warn her in the bathroom saying, hey, like, just so you know, the guy that you've been talking to all night has a prison tattoo.
Yeah.
And she just kind of brushes them off. And
even then, like, at first they were like, they were really just protecting themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of them said, oh, we should take care of this person who's obviously out of their depth in this situation. And
it was more out of their own like guilt. You know, it's like, if we don't say anything now, we're probably going to like feel bad about it later.
Yeah.
But then they felt bad about it later because, spoiler, Susan died.
I think it was really interesting how Christiana illustrates like the not only the tension between the local surfer girls and Susan, but also Susan and the local girls. Like Susan just assumes that they just don't like her.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. She says something like really snarky too. Yeah. She's like, oh, they're in paradise. What do they have to be mad about?
Yeah. And I mean, that's the name of the story. And that's what she keeps saying. This is paradise, right? That's her last words that you hear in the story is her saying, this is it. This is paradise. And I mean, that's the sales pitch of Hawaii, right? Especially Waikiki.
It's like the Las Vegas of Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like the glitz and glamour and, like they sell you like beautiful women in like coconut bras and grass hula skirts and drinks and like beautiful sunsets by the beach, like as if it's like a cover of a romance novel.
Right. And there's a line where they're saying if you walk outside of like the resort area, everyone versus like they shop at Macy's.
Yes.
Right.
Globalization at its best. But there is a passage from This is Paradise that I really liked, and I wrote it down in our Goodreads forums so I wouldn't forget. And it goes, we look at each other and we feel the heat rising in our faces. Our families are barely affording a life here. The land is being eaten away by developers. The old sugar companies still control water rights. Not only does paradise no longer belong to us, but we have to watch foreigners destroy it. Yeah, this is right after she says, they live in paradise. What is there to be mad about?
Yeah, and that happened after after they bring her in on a free shot that one of the surfer girls scored off the bartender, right? And it was really interesting within this group of surfer girls, because not all of them are also Native Hawaiian.
Yeah.
Right? So one of them was, I think she was from San Jose or San Francisco, and she moved to... Mm-hmm. Hawaii. And then one of the themes throughout all these stories is being local doesn't mean you're from there, but it means that you have assimilated, right? Or you have become like you're viewed as one of us, quote unquote, right?
Yes.
And that can happen whether or not you have any
Native Hawaiian blood in you.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. And like that group of girls, they were from all sorts of different, like...
different islands.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, one of them was from San Jose. And, yeah, like, after Susan's body is discovered, you know, despite all of these groups of women having, you know, disdain or, you know, judgment on this woman... they kind of come together in the end in like sisterhood, or like, I don't know. It's just like she was one of us, even though she was a foreigner. Like there's like some regret lingering there. It's like, well, we should have welcomed her more, or we should have warned her more seriously. We should have known better.
Yeah. I mean, that comes from the fact that they're all also women trying to survive.
Yes.
And there is also this tension, and I know I keep using this, but like I feel like this book is full of tensions, right? I mean, any good story is full of tensions. With the surfer girls, they hated that they were at this bar in this touristy part of town, but it was also the only place they can go to find like people to party with.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And the same way with the business ladies, a lot of them, there's this sense that like they almost regret having to come back to the islands to work when they could have followed like their college boyfriends or
yeah,
people
they,
to like work in DC or LA or like where they can be more.
Yeah. They, right? I think it was like one of the passages that said like they didn't have to come back to be pillars of a community, to be role models. And that they envy their police officer friend who, you know, got
never
married
left.
And, you know, she works like a local, like a very like minimal job of like training rookies and not really getting her own beat, I guess. I guess that's the word for police. I don't know. Like,
you're the Law and Order fan.
No, I'm not. I really don't like that show. But yeah, like the corporate women, they used to go to that bar where the surfer girls we're at, and they're like, oh man, remember the days when like when we were like naive and like would get drunk and party all the time. Thank God we grew up from that. And then like later on, after they find out that Susan had had died because of like a bad encounter with a man, they're just like, why didn't, like, she should have known better. Like, they start like victim blaming until one of them says, well, we weren't any different when we were 22. So
yeah, I mean, the last line was like, were we just lucky then?
Yeah, were we just lucky then? Right. Yeah, which is very chilling. But yeah, I really, really liked the first story. I thought it set the tone really well for this collection of short stories. I figured like right after I finished reading it, I thought that all of the other stories would be character sketches as well, because it seemed that is what Christiana seemed to be really good at, just like capturing all the nuances of a person.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't really talk much about the housekeeping staff. And I think their story was really, I know we were about to move on to the next story.
Oh,
but,
no, go right ahead.
I mean, I feel like their story was the story of Hawaii, the tourist destination, right? Because they're talking about, like, they were literally saying how they're told not to get in people's business. I think there was a passage where they said one of the housekeepers like tried to intervene when someone was like, looked like she was being attacked, and she got reprimanded by hotel staff. Mm-hmm. Right. And you compare that with like them pulling all the stops to do like a vigil for this woman who lost her life on their beach. And you kind of see that with the business ladies as well, where sure they came back to become pillars of their culture and to become role models, but also like they, like the surfer girls, understand how the companies that they're working for are kind of also destroying the place that they love.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Are we just going to go in order of the stories? Well, or are we going to...
I mean, that being said, which one was your favorite story?
I mean, like, surprisingly, I liked all of them, which is usually very rare for short story, story collections. I've only read a handful of short stories in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And usually those stories are much, much shorter. There's like a higher volume of short stories in the book, and then and they're like much, much shorter.
Right.
But for Christiana's collection, there's only 6 stories, and they're all like kind of longer than I expected them to be.
Yeah.
So that felt really good, because to me, it gave me more time to get acquainted with a character and to kind of drink in the setting. And I don't know, like, I thought the first one was so good, I thought that the rest would be like would not live up to my expectations. But I actually really liked the second story, Wan Lei.
That one, it's probably pronounced, well, I don't know, because I don't think they're using the correct Chinese pronunciation, which would be Wanla, but I think everything's kind of mixed in Hawaii. I didn't expect to get into a story about cockfighting.
Yeah, me neither. I like, because I absolutely abhor it. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate any kind of I guess like any kind of like violent sport, whether it's like between humans or animals, I just don't like it. I am very adverse to like gore and blood.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting, because the main character is a woman, and she is not bothered by all this violence, and she is kind of in a field where it's male dominated.
And she's also kind of like John Wick, where like it's a revenge story in a way.
In a way, yeah.
I liked it because I feel like it was an illustration of that thing they were talking about in the first story, where it's like, we were all young ones, right? And like, who we become as adults, like, could be completely different than like what we were as a young adult, I guess.
I also really, one aspect that I really, really loved about the second story was how she idolized her father, and her father was kind of seen as this hero to her, like this hero in cockfighting who, mm-hmm. you know, always knew what he was doing, was the best at what he did. But then she finds out that he was actually just really good at cheating and he had help. And, you know, I think all of us growing up, there's a moment in our lives where our parents become human beings rather than parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is like really relatable.
You mean the moral wasn't that all men will let you down?
I feel like every single person in your life will let you down at one point. Mm. It's just a matter of, do you forgive them? And can you forgive yourself for being naive?
Yeah. What did you think about the Indian?
The Indian. I don't know.
He seemed like a jerk, kind of, right? Like in just in the way that he was always trying to like correct her when like it's
yeah I see what you English, mean like to you know? To correct her to kind of like influence her
yeah.
to being the person that he wants her to be, which is never really healthy in any relationship.
Yeah.
If you can't accept the person for who they are, then get out as soon as possible. It does not make for a good relationship. But I thought that was like a pretty good turning point, though, when after she wins her match against Mr. O and she comes back to her house and she finds that all of the locks have been changed.
Yeah.
And she goes to the back where her chicken coop is and all of her belongings are
yeah.
tossed about. And then like she like in that moment, she's like, oh, I just have to like go apologize and he'll be OK with it. But as soon as she sees that he like murdered all of her chickens and all of the eggs, she realizes like, nope,
yeah.
I'm out of here. Like this is not something that I want in my life. And she also realizes that the Indian became his father. Like in that moment, he broke kind of like a code that he had for himself, which is to like never
do violence. Yeah.
So I thought that was like a pretty interesting turning point. The juxtaposition between like the cockfighting versus Wanlei taking care of her roosters, mm-hmm. how like she showed so much affection, how she would hum in order to calm them down, but at the same time, if they were too injured and they lost a battle, lost a match,
like Pokemon,
she would
Pokemon's actually just monster cockfighting.
Yes,
you know that,
are.
Right?
Yeah, I know.
Are you pro Pokemon fights?
No, I'm not. I just like catching them, which is probably why Pokemon Snap is my ideal game.
Sorry, I took you in the middle of a thought.
Oh, no, it's fine.
I just made the connection in my head.
This is
pretty much Pokemon.
and another part I really liked about Wanlei was the fact that she, you know, even though she was involved in cockfighting, which is like so violent, she was someone who had sensuality. She had like a softness to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was like really nice because oftentimes in stories, women in like more manly
right.
fields, they're just like, I have no emotions. I'm a robot. Whereas like she was able to be both, which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like in less capable hands, they would have completely made her like a masculine figure with like all the trappings of like emotionless, cold, ruthless. But luckily for us, Christiana is a more capable writer.
Yeah. And I also really like the ending of that story too. It just like was so satisfying to me because she runs into Mr. O again.
Yeah.
And instead of like kind of having like, I guess like a talk with him, like she originally wanted, he's just like, no, I'm good. Like,
yeah. I mean, it kind of goes to show that if you live your life a certain way, he can never like escape that. Right.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, Wanlei's father ran a dirty business and eventually paid the price because he was dealing with mobsters. Right. And Mr. O was the one who had him killed. And so from then on, like, he is always, he'll always be afraid of someone doing the same to him. Right. And it's like, you know, it's like, and Wang Lei was able to kind of break that chain, right?
Yeah.
By walking away.
Yeah. She was able to break that chain by, I guess, like, by just letting it go and just starting a new chapter in her life. And I really, that ending like really sat well with me. And,
yeah.
And it's just like, oh man, I don't really get that feeling from short stories. Usually I'm like, give me more.
Yeah.
Or that's it. That's usually my two reactions to short stories.
I mean, to be fair, that's what Wang Lei thought about when she finally beat Mr. Oh. It's like, that's it. And it, that moment reminded me of the speech from M. Bison in Street Fighter the movie.
Oh.
Where he was like, that day was the most important day of your life. But to me, it was a Wednesday. like when she saw like just how little he cared about losing to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of like subverting gender stereotypes and being in a field where like it's male dominated, there's another story in this book where you have a character who is breaking gender stereotypes. And I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Which one was it?
The Old Panola Way.
Right. That's the last.
That's the last story.
Yeah.
Yes. I guess we can jump into that.
Yeah. Panola, I'm assuming, because I didn't look this up, is just Hawaiian for rancher, right?
Rancher, cowboy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have a character who is a hospice nurse, and you know that's usually a field that's dominated by women.
I mean, it's a story about a dying dad, right? And we've seen these stories before. You know, people trying to find closure and all that.
The story about the son coming back home to like
take care of an ailing father.
Yeah, to say goodbye to his ailing father and running into kind of old problems that never really settled down before they left.
Yeah. We've all seen this story before.
Doesn't mean that it's not done well, though.
And then not in the setting, right? Which I'm way more interested in.
I really liked how it introduced like sexuality into it, because I feel like that is as we move forward in our lives, like gender identity and sexuality, it evolves every year. Mm-hmm. And of course, our parents' generation, they can be a lot more conservative or uneducated in those ideas.
Yeah.
And
I mean, we've all been there where our parents say things where like, Mom, Dad, you can't say those anymore.
Or we all have like parts of ourselves where we're afraid to reveal that part of ourselves to like our family.
Yeah.
And being like, oh, you only get to see one layer of me because otherwise, disgrace.
Yeah. I mean, the store is also a story about coming out.
Yes, right? Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And I thought it was so, I mean, the main character is Pilipo, yeah.
P-I-L-I-P-O, Pilipo.
And Pili for short. And he is a successful marketing executive at age 31, which is how?
In San Francisco.
How? but yeah, he comes home and is kind of confronted with his absence. And like, again, we've seen the story before, right? Like you have the sister who's been there the whole time and kind of feeling like, well, now you're here. And like, now you're kind of taking my spot. Like his sister Miley has been, as with other characters in this book, like someone who has never left the islands. And she's been taking care of her father his entire illness, right? And then in comes her younger brother, who's like obviously favored by the dad too, right?
I don't think it's like favored, but it's like a different kind of relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Because like it's like father-son relationship. So their relationship has something that she doesn't have with her father. And I guess one of that is like the ranch itself. Mm-hmm. Like her father would prefer Pili to have ownership of the ranch and to keep things as is. Whereas right. Miley, she is introducing new techniques with taking care of the horses and, you know,
like technology.
newfangled. And her dad's just feeding. Like, oh, no, just like if I leave the ranch to you, like my son, I know that things will remain the same and will be kept in the family and yada, yada, yada. There's a lot of patriarchy in there, too, and a lot of like sexism.
Yeah. I mean, I like how the father, Harrison, is portrayed as like a real rugged man's man, like a real cowboy, right?
A manly man.
Yeah. I mean, Harrison is a very manly man name.
Yeah.
You know?
But I liked how like this was a coming out story. But really, the coming out seemed to be between Pili and his sister.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also a story about how we find closure with the passing of loved ones or important people in our lives, right?
Yeah.
And there is that passage where Pili finally confronts his sister about the tension between them and saying that he wants to come out. Yeah, it was right after their father falls into a coma. Right. And is pretty much on his deathbed. And when that happens, like he was out making sweet love with the hospice nurse.
With Albert.
And they were just fighting about like all of the unspoken like kind of tensions between them throughout the story.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of like anger and resentment. Like with Miley, it's like, you know, I've been here the entire time where you only visited maybe like once every like 5 months.
Yeah, like and you're the one that ran away. And also, like, I know you're gay.
Yeah.
And I've been covering for you.
Yeah, I've been covering for you. Right. And then like with Pili, that sets him off. That's the reason why he comes out to his father. Because he's like, we could have had a normal family relationship if you did not cover for me. If like... A lot of this tension could have been saved if you hadn't, like, hidden a really important part of my identity.
Right. And then she comes back saying that you're the one that left because you couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, like, she kind of puts in the contrast that, like, coming out to their father now will only serve one person.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, if he had come out, like, years before, maybe we could have had that relationship that you want. But at this point, like, what do you expect to happen? Like, dad can't even hear, like, respond to you anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that's, he goes and does that. And it's really funny because he comes out to his father on his deathbed in a coma by giving Albert the blanket that his father gave his mother as an engagement present.
Yeah.
And I don't think Albert knew anything about the context of that gift. So he goes, oh, this is real nice. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Right. I thought that was funny.
Yeah. But it was really, really nice that like you had queerness introduced into the story, because I feel like I'm not an expert on, Pacific Islander culture. And obviously there are like it's a very, very broad spectrum, considering it's not just like one island, it's like multiple several islands. But it seems to me that there's a lot of like patriarchy and a lot of like gender roles within the community. And it's just like you get a sense of that when the story does like a flashback to when Pili was going to a hotel or a country club with his dad, and they see a trans woman, and Pili doesn't know that that person is trans. And then his father is like, his father says some really, really like homophobic and transphobic things. And I don't know, like it. I feel like we get a lot of coming out stories in the white people scene, but we don't really get that many in even Asian America. And we also don't really want all queer stories to be tragedies as well. That seems to be also a trend in like a lot of stories that feature queer characters, which is why I like stories like Not Your Sidekick.
It's
like really refreshing because like you have queer characters doing fun things and it's not all about coming out and there's not like the whole story isn't about trauma.
Yeah. I thought it was nice to see the two siblings reconcile at the end of the story, right? In a quiet way, not in like there wasn't like a big emotional scene where they like apologize to each other. But it kind of goes to show that, you know, for most people, I feel like the family bond is something that you can't like some things can be communicated without being a big thing. Like,
yeah.
Outspoken. Right.
Yeah. I think that that is like a very realistic thing.
Yeah.
You know, like you sometimes you don't have to apologize. You just make up for it by little actions.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Peely did apologize to his sister for not showing up sooner, not helping her out. But he also like let her take the day off to go see her friends and like kind of took responsibility for that day. And that's kind of like how families are sometimes. Like they might not always say, I'm sorry, but, you know, some things are communicated without words.
Yeah. And I really love the way that Christiana writes about the way people touch each other.
Yes. Very, very tactile prose. Yeah. You can, I said so in my Goodreads comment. I said that like she writes scents and touches really, really well. And I think that skill came in handy for her because she used to write for a wine magazine. she used to write for a wine magazine. And I'm like, ah, yes. How do you deliver descriptions of taste and smell to your readers? And it shows in her writing in this short story collection.
Yeah.
A lot of the food definitely plays a really big part in her stories.
I mean, so my favorite story from the collection is actually the fourth one, which is also the shortest one. The
39 Rules for Making a Hawaiian Funeral into a Drinking Game.
Yeah.
That one. I really like that one too.
And I think I like that the most because I think I connected to it the most. Because I remember...
I think it's very universal.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it is. And especially if you've lost a grandparent and have had to go back to the funeral. And like, granted, Chinese funerals aren't as big a party as Hawaiian ones, apparently. But the idea of like kind of bringing family together, and especially when it brings you back to like a homeland that's not really yours.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's extra universal for those of us who are second generation, like immigrants.
Yes.
And I think, you know, what I loved about that story was like the way that it ended was the narrator kind of realizing that she's finally been accepted.
Yeah.
Into the family, right? Whereas throughout the entire story, she was kind of not sure where she like belongs.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. As like someone who is a mainlander, as someone
and a Hapa.
And a Hapa, and as someone who like did not grow up in the islands, mm-hmm. or did not come back as often as she should have. And then also her father, who, you know, is kind of an outsider because he left the island. But even before he left the island, he wasn't into the same activities as his peers.
He wasn't a manly man.
He did not play football.
He was the sensitive
one. I did not know that football was like a thing in Hawaii
it's
as
huge.
Well.
Like there's a ton of like Hawaiians that are offensive linemen in the NFL.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I have zero interest in football. One of the passages I really liked from that short story is this. I'm pretty sure you will know why. Hmm. With your degree in English, your aunties expect you to deliver the most grammatically correct homage to your grandmother. Take this responsibility seriously. Your copy editing skills are all you have to offer your family.
Did that hit home for you?
Oh, yeah. I am the person that all of my cousins call if they need to like get their... their essays edited. I feel like I've looked at every single college application essay sent in by my cousins.
Yeah. But what was really funny was right after that, like that passage, she immediately just fucks it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like she forgets to introduce herself and she kind of like rushes through details and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like it. This short story was like really funny to me. It was a mix of a lot of things. Like obviously grief because you are mourning someone that you love, and also she's seeing a lot of her male relatives cry for the first time.
Yeah.
So there's like grief, vulnerability, and also just like longing and regret for not being on the island for as long as she wanted and stuff like that. But also, like, there's a lot of humor in it, and yeah. I really appreciated that. Maybe like, as someone who really loves dark comedy. And
like, all the shade they're throwing at the pastor.
Oh, yeah. Like, I don't know the history of, like colonialism in Hawaii.
Oh, it's pretty bad.
I know it's pretty bad, but in terms of, like, religion, you know? Like,
I mean, colonial religion...
I don't know. I was just like,
kind of the tool of colonists, the colonizer, right?
Well, I was really surprised that like her family was super Christian.
Mm.
You know, like I was just like, oh, I didn't know that. Like Hawaiians, like have a deep.
I feel like a lot of them are, and that's a direct result of
colonialism.
It's
yeah.
like, well, a lot of Koreans are Catholic too, right?
No, we're
Protestant. I don't know.
Protestant,
I don't know what
mostly.
You all are.
We're mostly, we're like 50-50, like half of us are Christian and the other half are Buddhist. But yeah, I did not know that about Hawaii. So that was like really interesting to me because in the beginning, like you have the main character being like, oh, this pastor, he keeps saying like...
Y'all go to hell.
You're all going to go to hell and... And it's like super hypocritical and no one is taking this pastor seriously.
Yeah. But also she mentions that this pastor also cheated his grandma out of like years
of her
of
savings. Yeah. Yeah.
And the passage where she says like, drink when the pastor claims deeds get us into heaven. Deeds like tithing to the church. Deeds like tithing to his church. Do not comment on how this is unbiblical. Do not comment on how he encouraged her grandmother to give until she had no money left for the upkeep of her house. Do not comment on the Louis Vuitton man purse you've seen them carry into church. And I think, that leads directly into like the latter parts of this story where she's sitting with her female cousins and they're kind of shit talking. Like the cousins are shit talking the pastor. And then her baby cousins are covering behind her to see what she says. To see what she'll say about it. And she thinks in her head that she should be a good, like, be good and, like, praise the pastor. But what she ends up saying is, I don't trust a man with a pedicure, right?
Yeah.
And then everyone's just like, I think that's when they, like, really see her as, like, oh, you're definitely one of us, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, yeah, like they're not taking this guy seriously at all. It's just a ritual because of, like... Because apparently the family is Christian.
Yeah, because the family is Christian. Yeah, like the relationship between her and different aunties and cousins, like that was really interesting to read about as well. Yeah, it just like goes to show that like there can be joy in also grieving. You know, there is like this this comfort to it as well.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I've gone to like a like a funeral. So
it's another example in this book of someone who, like, even if they didn't grow up in the culture, identifies completely with it. And mm-hmm. I think we can see that also in the third story, Road to Hana.
Smooth.
Which actually, like, I've actually been on that road.
You've been to Hawaii before?
I went to Maui for a wedding.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we kind of stuck around for a week and just like
that's cool.
Drink beer and drove around.
I want to go. I have two friends they go to Hawaii every year. They just came back from Hawaii like a couple weeks ago, and I'm just like, what is that like? Like, what is it like to go to Hawaii every year, and not even just like the same island every year, just like and they also have like a friend there who's like getting her PhD, so it's just like, oh, I like the only Hawaii I recognize are like stuff from Terrace House. Like,
what's well, I mean, in this story, this is a couple taking a vacation to Maui from Honolulu.
From Honolulu, yeah.
So even within the islands, it's like a vacation from quote unquote paradise.
Yeah. But this story did a really good job exploring like what does it mean to be a local and what does it mean to be like a foreigner, because you have two characters who kind of identify themselves as Hawaiian, as local.
Yeah.
In two completely different ways. You have Cameron, who was born and raised in Honolulu, who teaches in Honolulu, and but he's white, and his parents are originally from Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So he feels kind of apprehensive to call himself, you know, a Hawaiian, but he recognizes that he is local. Whereas his girlfriend, Becky, she is of Native Hawaiian descent,
mm-hmm.
but she's from the mainland. She's from Vegas. So like, and her entire family lives in Vegas as well.
Right. They all moved out there.
Yeah. So her main connection to Hawaii is her ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
So two totally different ways of identification to Hawaii. And actually, I actually wrote down a passage from that story as well. And this is when Becky tells Cameron that he's from Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And in his inner dialogue, he says he wanted to say he wasn't from Minnesota. He was from Hawaii. Yet that didn't seem quite right. He was local. He knew that much. He was local and she wasn't. But did that matter? Was local being from a place or just of it?
Yeah. And like, to him, he grew up there. So I think it's the same way that I kind of claim that, like, so I was born in Canada. I was born in Toronto, but I was raised in LA, in San Gabriel. And so I always tell people, like, I'm culturally Californian, like, but like, technically I'm from Canada and legally I'm from Canada. But to me, I feel like I'm from LA, and I tell people I'm from LA.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the thing is, you can be more than one thing. I think that is the big lesson, if you will, to take away from this short story collection. You can be more than one thing, and there isn't really one definitive way to be local or to be native, I guess. It's just all like, it's all about nuance, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to see the two, like, the differences in how they both also approach being in Maui.
Yeah.
Right. He's very, like, not type A, but like very neurotic about it. Right. Or
what's the right word? I don't know if he was neurotic about it. But since we're going into like personalities, what I really liked about this story is how, like, just one incident with a dog just kind of like was the catalyst for ruining their relationship and just like kind of peeling back, like, oh, this is who they really are.
Yeah.
And maybe they're not as perfect as I thought they were.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, this is a really intense, like, not a breakup, because they obviously did not break up at the end. But I was like, oh, wow, this is kind of like a very relatable moment where you realize that the relationship might not work.
Yeah. And this goes to his inability to like let things go.
Right? Yeah.
Or to stop thinking, like, because she's very much more of like a go with the flow type of person. You can tell, right? She thinks first, like she acts first and thinks later.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And he's more like think first, think a lot, and then maybe act.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the scene where they eat the freshwater shrimps, right? And she's like, I'm going to make a peanut butter jelly sandwich. Like, not the first time a peanut butter jelly sandwich has appeared in this series of stories.
Yes.
And she like makes one for him because like, you didn't eat enough. You're going to be hungry still. He's just being like pouty about it.
Yeah. But she also was the one who was like, we can't leave this flea ridden dog out in the middle of the road. I'm just like, yo, like, it's a stray dog. Like, just let it go. Because she's very insistent that, like, they find out who the owner is, when it's very clear that the dog does not have an owner. And when he turns into, like where, like, this really nice house is, he's like, we can just leave the dog here, and then we can be on our way. And she's like, no, like, it'll like, run out into the street, and... like,
well, because he was trying to keep to his schedule, right? The schedule he laid out. He wants to get to the campsite before dark.
Okay, that is just like common sense, in my opinion. It's not even being like neurotic about it. It's, you know, you want to start a fire before it gets dark because you won't be able to find anything. I'm type A, so maybe maybe I'm being a little obviously bit biased here.
Obviously, we're relating to different people in this story.
Yes. Can you tell which one plans for, picks out the books and plans out the news? Yeah, but I really like that story. It's probably the shortest one out of the bunch, I think.
I thought the funeral one was the shortest one, I felt like.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you're right.
I think more stuff happens in the funeral one than in the Rotohana. I think Rotohana is like, it's a lot of, not a lot of plot happening, more a lot of like internal monologuing.
I feel like that's all of them, though. It's a lot of like inner monologue and a lot of like character sketches. I think Rotohana was probably the most linear because you're not like, there aren't like hundreds of characters who like jump heads. It's literally just two people, and you're not jumping in timelines or flashbacks or anything like that. So it is like relatively the most simple and linear story out of the bunch, but like I think it was just as good as all of the other ones. The one story that critics seem to really, really love and praise is Portrait of a Good Father.
Right.
Which I thought was very surprising because like New York Times and a bunch of other publications have said that Portrait of a Good Father is like the best one out of the short story collection.
Okay.
And I was like, huh. That was my least favorite one out of the bunch. I mean, I really liked it, but I felt like the other stories stood out way more to me. So I was like, my taste versus critical taste.
Well, I mean, not even critical taste, but like think about who's probably the critic is.
White people who have studied dead white people works for decades.
I mean, it's definitely the most I don't even want to say the most tragic. It was probably the most tragic of it.
Yeah, right? Like I feel like it had the most melancholy.
Yeah.
Like out of all of it. Cuz even like the drinking game funeral story, like it was funny and
yeah.
There was like definitely more,
I mean, but it wasn't about, like, there wasn't despair, right? Tons of despair.
Yeah, this one had definitely, I mean, like, a kid dies.
Yeah.
You can't get any more, like, sad than that.
And it's a lot of, like, it like, speaking of Celeste Ng, it gave a lot of the same feelings I had reading Everything I Never Told You.
Oh, my God, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, you're right.
Or how, like, this was a family that was already unraveling. And, like, you later find out, by the end of the story, that like it was unraveling even before it even began, right? And like it was like the death of this child just like was the catalyst.
Yeah, right? That relationship was doomed from the start. I really liked the way it started. It was very cinematic to me.
Mm-hmm.
You start with Sarah. She's moving into her dorms, or she's already in her dorms, and she has a picture of her. of her dad from when he was 19 years old. And then you kind of like flash back into her father and mother's like kind of backstory.
Yeah.
And
so I don't even think it's in her dorm room. She's like, she's in college and she's describing the picture that used to hang in her front door, I want to say.
Or, yeah. But it starts with the photograph. Yeah. And I think like that was what really like lured me in, because I was like, oh man, we're going like Citizen Kane here. Which, yeah, I mean,
yeah,
but I thought that was a really interesting way to set up the story and to kind of set up the relationships, because like the photograph comes back at the end of the story.
Yeah.
And you kind of realize like how it was kind of taken and what kind of relationship Grace and the dad, I don't remember the dad's name.
Kiaka. Again, it's a representation for Sarah of the idealized father that she had in her mind.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, to put it in like very, very simplistic like words, it's about love and jealousy. It's about kind of comparing your relationship to other people and just kind of being disappointed all around, and just kind of never meeting expectations, never being enough
right
for the relationship. And you kind of get that feeling from everyone, from like Grace and Kiaka. Like they, for Kiaka, he will never be like enough of a father or a husband. And for Grace, it's like, why doesn't he love me the same amount or more than June, the Korean woman that he's having an affair with?
Yeah. And I mean, you get shades of that from the very beginning when you realize that they pretty much have like a shotgun wedding. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like they're getting married because she's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then the son, John Boy, is already 10 months old when they do get married officially.
Yeah.
And even in those first scenes, you start to see that these two people might not really be right for each other.
Yeah.
It does seem like Kiaka is more interested in being a dad than being a husband. Right. At least to Grace. I think it was the last section of the story where you realize, or where they reveal, that June was already having a relationship with Kiaka before Grace was even in the picture, like before the wedding.
Yeah. Before the wedding, at the very least. It was, like you said, there was a lot of despair in it. Especially after their firstborn gets tragically killed in a car accident, and just reading parts where Sarah feels so much guilt for being the one who was there when it happened, and for like not holding her brother's hand fast enough, for stalling, for not paying attention. And that just kind of like gets unloaded onto her crush, who she would wait for on that street. And it's like, oh boy, that part was really rough to read. But it was out of the other stories, I feel like that one was like the hardest one to read in terms of like emotional turmoil. I feel like there was like a lot more there. And the fights between Grace and Kiaka, that was like,
yeah,
that was like real rough too.
And then like being overheard by Sarah, who comprehended it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What's definitely being felt there is like this profound loss and how everyone responds to it.
Yeah, because you have Kiaka, who like kind of is numb from his son's passing, and it's just like, I just want to move on with my life. And then you have Grace, who is constantly remembering her firstborn and constantly comparing, I feel like unknowingly comparing Sarah, her daughter, to her son.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't even realize how much you're hurting your daughter because you're grieving for your son. And I think there's like a quote in the story where Sarah recognizes that she will never be she will never measure up to her dead brother's potential. And she's like, well, that's just something that I have to live with. And the same kind of sentiment is felt with June when she is pregnant with Jake.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, my son is probably not going to live up to Kiaka's first son. And like, we're probably not going to be as loved as like his dead son and as his daughter. But that is just something that I have to live with. And that is something that I have to just swallow. And, you know, that's like, that is not really a kind of love that I wish on anybody. Like,
I mean, Kiaka definitely struggles with it, right? Because he's just trying to be a good dude.
He's trying to be a good father.
Right.
Yes, a good father. Not so much a good husband. I feel like he could have tried a little bit harder with that.
Yeah. But... And there was that last line where she pretty much tells him, like, how dare you love them the same as me?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. She knows that he's being a good father and he lies to her. And yeah. She's just like, I know that, like, this is the answer that he should say, but that's not like, like, that's not how I feel. And it just goes to show being like having expectations for your parents, it's always going to be really contradictory. And it flows really well with the final story with the old.
But it's interesting that this was also the story that probably had the least to do with Hawaii culture.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, all of them were really just about people and their relationships with their fathers and relationship with. I keep saying character studies, but that's what these short stories are. Like, it's more about. Just everyday life, slice of life on different islands.
How did you keep up with all the pigeon?
I really liked it. I thought it would drive me crazy because I freaking hated Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Like, it drove me nuts. And I've definitely read books where, like I read books in high school where like Southern dialect was like written out, and it's just like, I can't stand reading this Southern garbage. I say this as someone who is from the South, and I think it really just help you dive into the setting much quicker. And I really appreciated the fact that there wasn't a glossary or there weren't footnotes.
Yeah.
Because if you're actually going to Hawaii and you like run into someone who speaks that way, you don't have a glossary. You just have to kind of figure out what they're saying. It definitely put you in the seat of like an outsider.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, like, I'm cool with that. That's fine.
Yeah. I think I had to figure a lot of stuff out, especially when they use slang in context. But it was also interesting how certain characters would, you know, code switch and certain characters just wouldn't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And like how they described it in different ways too. Like sometimes it's being described as like proper, sometimes it's precise.
Academic,
yeah. But it was surprisingly easy to follow along with.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it definitely gave you like a better glimpse into the characters. Like in Wan Lei, when she moves to the big island for education and to become a chef, she loses her pigeon. Like, that is something that is like a language of the past now. and then you have characters like Harrison, who does not speak in academic English at all.
Yeah.
So you kind of like get a sense of like where they are in their lives and how their identity has been shaped in their formative years.
Yeah.
If you left like the smaller islands for a mainland or for the big island, like obviously your pigeon is going to be much more diluted than the people who stayed.
Yeah.
So there was like definitely, so the pigeon was really interesting because you kind of see a divide almost immediately in terms of like who is considered an outsider amongst the locals and all that. So
yeah, yeah. I mean, it makes me think that, is that what we sounded like to the British when we?
Oh, like 100%. Yeah.
Where they're like, what are you doing to?
Okay, I'm gonna. So like, Americans think that British accents are like,
so they're academic, right? They're highfalutin.
It's like, oh, they're so posh or whatever. But what they don't realize is that the accents that they use on television is fake. It's called RP, like RP English. Uh-huh. And that is just an accent that British actors use so that the rest of the population can understand what they're saying. Because every single neighborhood in England, mm-hmm, speak like completely different. I'm pretty sure if you spend like a day in London, you will probably be horrified as someone who like, it's like, oh, British people are so posh. Well, no, spend a day in London.
The same way, like every newscaster in the States take on, I think it's like, what, the Connecticut accent or some like,
yeah, it's
Vermont
like a,
accent or something.
It's like a standard.
The mid-Atlantic, like standard, like it's what mainstream media has declared as normal English.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same with every country, I think. I don't know how it is with China, considering that like dialects are vastly different.
We have they call it 普通话, which is just normal language. Standard language, yeah.
Yeah, same thing with Korea. The standard accent is the Seoul accent or the Gyeonggi-do accent. But like dialects in other regions are vastly different.
Yeah.
To a point where I actually have... Actually, with some of my Korean American friends, I can tell if their parents are from Seoul or from Busan or from other region, because they picked up that accent from their parents when they speak Korean. So I have a friend whose parents are from Busan originally, mm-hmm, and when she talks in Korean, I'm like, "Oh, you have a Busan accent," and she's like, "Really? I just feel like I was like, I'm just talking in Korean, though." And I'm like, no, that's not like the standard accent. So
I mean, I definitely have a Taiwanese accent in my Mandarin when I speak it.
Yeah. So to answer your question, yes, we sound weird to British people. And British people sound weird to us.
Yeah. I thought it was just like so interesting that they called it like academic or precise, as if like there is a right and wrong. I mean, I think that was one of the things that, like, people who spoke like academic English were telling the people speaking pidgin that was the wrong way to talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the things you put up with as someone from Hawaii, like local from Hawaii.
Yes. Right? The colonizers will constantly tell you that you are wrong and that they are superior.
Yeah. Well, we were able to get through all six short stories.
Yes. I am very proud of us. But I think Christiana did a really good job with portraying Hawaii in kind of like this kaleidoscope, you know? It was a very nuanced view, and I really appreciated it, considering how little I know of Hawaii and how any books I have read that, like, take place in Hawaii have been written by white people or written in a very tourist viewpoint. So it was really, really nice to get like some authenticity, some nuance.
It's always good to see stories from the people who live in the places.
I know Christiana is, she's a Hapa, first off. She is of native Hawaiian, German, and Norwegian descent. She's mainly from California, but she lived in the East Coast for some time, and her family is based in Maui.
Mm.
So she spent her childhood in Maui. But like, she mainly grew up in the States, so she carries all these different identities, and like, it really, really helped her. It really equipped her to write such varying perspectives in her work.
Yeah, I think a lot of the comments we got from Goodreads all were praising the book's nuanced portrayal of the Hawaiian people.
Like, Hawaii is often seen as like Disneyland, you know? So it's just like, yeah, you get a Hawaii that is like not pristine. There's some grit to it here.
Yeah, like these are real stories of people who live here.
People have problems with their dads. People have problems making a living. Like, yeah, it's not just
another day in paradise. But yeah, thanks to Lauren Lola and Julie from 3x5 Books for writing in and expressing their thoughts on the story. So yeah, thanks for joining us for a discussion of This is Paradise by Christiana Kahakawila. I hope you enjoyed reading the book as much as we did. And if you have any thoughts on the stuff that we talked about or would like to add to the discussion, please let us know on our Goodreads forums. You can find it by going to goodreads.com and searching Books and Boba. And on that note, I guess it's time to figure out what we're reading for the month of June, which is very exciting because we're finally, both Rira and I are reading our very first Haruki Murakami book. And we put a poll out on Twitter and we had a lot of people write in as well about their thoughts.
Write in from Instagram and commenting on the poll itself.
Yeah.
So it looks like the clear winner is Kafka on the Shore. So that's probably what we're going to be reading.
Okay.
But I will read some of the other choices that people sent us.
The losers.
After Dark was a popular write-in choice from both Instagram and Twitter. We had a couple people say Killing Commendator. Hopefully that is the correct pronunciation.
Commendatory.
But the most recent Murakami book, like, okay, that one is the most recent one, which I was really surprised. I thought people would be more insistent with his older pieces.
I think people just want to read stuff they haven't read yet.
Yeah. I think that's another thing, too. I had two people say,
which was not the question we were asking.
I had two people say, oh, I would say IQ 84, but like, it's really long. And I'm that is why it is exempt from the poll. Same thing with Norwegian Wood. We had a couple people say, Norwegian Wood is my favorite, but since you guys are not considering it, like.
And if you listen to our last episode, you know why.
Yes. So Kafka on the Shore seems to be our clear winner.
Right.
But thank you, everyone, for submitting your suggestions and for voting as well. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I will read more than one Murakami book in my life, so I will check out the other ones.
Every June we will read a Murakami book.
You know what? That's doable. Once a year.
So yeah, Kafka on the Shore by Haruki Murakami is our Books and Boba June 2019 book club pick. We look forward to reading with all of you, and I look forward to I guess reading my first Murakami.
Yeah, let's see what the hype is all about, you know?
And on that note, that'll also do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thanks a lot for tuning in and joining us on this journey. Rira, thanks for always recommending such great books.
We get the recommendations from our readers, and not readers, from our listeners as well.
Yeah. If you enjoyed our conversation and have not subscribed to us yet, you can do so on Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Books and Boba.
And please share your thoughts in the Goodreads forums. If you're a lurker, I would love to know your name and why you listen to this podcast and what your thoughts are.
Yeah.
I also love getting book recommendations from you all. So,
let us
hi.
Know. Let us know who you are. Tell us about your thoughts. And if there's any cool stuff that's happening that we haven't touched on, please create a thread and let's talk about it. We'd like to also thank the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts, for having us as part of their network. You can learn more about our fellow Potluck podcasts by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. And finally, this podcast was recorded at the Potluck Podcast Studios, located in Little Tokyo at the Visual Communications offices. Visual Communications is an amazing nonprofit and Asian American media center behind the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival. You can learn more about their programs by going to their website, vcmedia.org. And with that, we'll see you next time on Books and Boba.
Great. Bye.
Hi, this is Taz.
And this is Zara.
And we are the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast. It is a show about being two Muslim women in America.
We talk about pop culture, the pork lobby, periods.
And we talk about Islamophobia, patriarchy, and smashing white supremacy.
It's a range.
Download the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Or at goodmuslimbadmuslim.com.